You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In 1886, Vancouver's first city council petitioned the federal government to lease 1,000 acres of a largely logged peninsula for park and recreation purposes. On September 27, 1887, Stanley Park was officially opened and became Vancouver's first official green space. An exhibition at the Vancouver Museum celebrates the park's 120th birthday. It's titled The Unnatural History of Stanley Park and aims to shed some light on what it calls puzzling blind spots in our romance with the park. Joan Seidel curated the exhibition, and she joins me by phone this morning from her home in Vancouver. Hello, Joan.
Hello.
Now, you start the exhibit with the windstorm of December 2006, which blew down so many trees in the park. Why did you start there?
Well, we thought it was, first of all, an emotional starting point for a lot of people in terms of thinking about the park these days. It was this intense moment when people realized how much they cared for the park and how much was at stake if they lost the park. So it seemed like a kind of way to harness all that energy and intensity, which we were hoping then that we could get people to turn to this more challenging topic of the way in which Stanley Park has been constructed.
I love that first room in the exhibition. There are floor-to-ceiling columns, gyprock columns, and then light projected on them. So they suggest trees, but they are not natural. So I just love the way you are playing with those ideas.
Well, we worked with really talented designers. So, I mean, my brief to the exhibit designer, Sholto Scruton, was hit the unnatural hard. And so his response was to come up with an exhibit that uses severely geometric forms as much as possible. And in that case, you're right, he takes these incredibly abstract, they're really just columns, and using lighting manages to turn them into a wonderful sort of a lit forest.
And at the same time, you have all the media coverage around you playing of that windstorm. And I mean, I can actually remember some of it as I go in there.
Oh, that's great. Yes, as visitors walk through this space, we make you kind of walk around tumbled down, abstracted trees. It's your motion that's triggering these different voices and soundtracks. And then I don't know. I'm sure you got the idea that as you stood right at the entrance, there was a moment when you could read Stanley Park.
Oh yes.
In the distance, and then as you walk forward, that Stanley Park, those words sort of shatter and fall apart. Just using the trick of perspective that we were doing there.
No, I did. I didn't. I loved that too. But I had no idea that my motion was actually triggering what was happening in there.
Yes. 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 Yes.
Very, very nice.
And we tried to hide the words, too. I mean, so that the first thing when you come in, we don't, like, blast you with a load of text or anything, that you have to pass through this blowdown experience, and then we tell you the story of blowdowns. In other words, that there have been a bazillion of them and some really bad ones. And this last one, yes, it was terrible, but in the history of Stanley Park, that's a forest which is always being buffeted and changed by nature.
Now, as I said in my introduction, the land that became the park had been logged. How did that affect the environment that we see there now?
Well, it changed the nature of the forest. It was particularly the western red cedar and the Douglas firs that were valuable to the logging companies, and not the hemlock, which tends to be a weaker tree that's quite splintery and vulnerable also to a parasite which there's no cure for. So when the forest was logged, they tended to leave behind a lot of the hemlock. And also the hemlock is a aggressive species which can take root and thrive in a situation where loggings happen. So you tend to have a forest that is not sort of what they sometimes, in my grade school, I now know this is an old-fashioned concept, but we used to call a balanced forest, right? A mature, forest. Instead of that, you have this sort of unbalanced forest that was that had a lot of hemlock in it, and that's still the forest that we've inherited today. And so when we drove through Stanley Park after the blowdown and saw those incredibly splintery trees that were just, it looked like they were shattered, most of those were hemlock.
Now, you say that we've interfered with and altered and rearranged Stanley Park to make nature more natural. How has this approach affected how the trees themselves, the individual trees, have been dealt with over time?
Well, I think that we won't go to the hollow tree quite yet, but I'll start with saying that I think the first time individual trees were really manipulated and made to perform as nature was in 1914, when the Parks Board superintendent at that time reported that there was a particularly beautiful old tree that was clearly dying, and he wanted to do something about it. So he hollowed it out and filled it with concrete to see whether this would maintain it. Of course, it didn't. It probably, in fact, speeded its demise. But this idea that even then we were wanting Stanley Park to be not nature, but our version of nature, to perform as nature.
Now, let's go to the hollow tree.
Okay.
What is the history of the hollow tree?
Well, the hollow tree has been a landmark in Stanley Park from very early on. By 1890, people are having their photographs taken in front of the hollow tree, and it has been a really important Vancouver landmark. I think it's in the early days, there's lots of images of people driving horses and buggies into the park, into the tree to have their photo taken, or backing an old car into the tree. We've got in our postcard room, in the postcard display in the exhibit, you can kind of trace the history of these scenes with the hollow tree. And there's no doubt about it that the hollow tree that we see nowadays is, I mean, even in the last 20 years, it's physically diminished. It's literally smaller. It's shrinking. Its biomass is disintegrating.
Now, if we turn to the animal yes. inhabitants of the park, I understand that there was an annual crow shoot in the early 1900s. Why was that?
The Parks Board was concerned that crows were feeding on various things like other species like duck eggs that they were trying to promote, and the gun club members, Vancouver Gun Club members, were allowed to request license to shoot crows. They had to do it early in the morning before 6 a.m., and they had to do it it was usually in the month of April. But yes, please go shoot the crows, right? I know it continued to 1920, but I've also heard from someone that they were doing it around 1950. So it may have, in fact, continued much closer to the present, and the records are just a little absent.
There's many, many interesting facts in this exhibition, but one of the other interesting ones that struck me was that the zoo was trapping owls and hawks that were feeding on the ducklings.
Oh, yes.
And then there was too many ducks.
Yes, yes, too many ducks, but they solved that problem. They shot the ducks and gave them to the Children's Aid Society for Christmas dinner for the orphans, yes.
Really an amazing amount of manipulation
yes,
goes on
yes.
in that park.
And every time they did something, I mean, as you would expect, something else happened, an unanticipated consequence.
Now, I'm interested in the history of some of the famous landmarks in Stanley Park. Let's start with Lost Lagoon. Is that a natural feature at all?
Well, what we call Lost Lagoon used to look very different and was, in fact, a different kind of beast. It was a tidal mud flat. Where we go into Stanley Park on the Georgia Street entrance, there was no land bridge there. It was just open to Coal Harbor, and the tides washed in and washed out during the course of a day. And it was in ancient times a very rich clam bed, and accounts for some of the enormous shell middens that are found in the park. But early on, a bridge was built across there. The tide still washed in and washed out. But over time, there was this idea that the tidal mudflat, which when it was, that got pretty smelly and wasn't considered unsightly, an unsightly form of nature, needed to be beautified. And so when they dug sewers in the West End and when they excavated for streets in the West End, they took the sort of sweepings and leavings and whatnot from these West End excavations, and they gradually, in the 1920s, filled in a land bridge, which became what we think of as the Georgia Street entrance.
Right, and then created the
they created a sort of more separate area. It's still in the early days, there was a large pipe that allowed the tidal floods to come in and out, but finally, by the end of the 1920s, they shut off that pipe, and Lost Lagoon became its own separate kind of stultifying but theoretically freshwater lagoon.
Now, there was a zoo in Stanley Park for 100 years until it was voted out in a referendum in 1993. How did the zoo idea get started?
It was really very haphazard. The first superintendent of the park actually lived in the park. It was a man named Harry Allison, and he lived in with his family. And his kids had a pet bear, which they staked out near their house. And as people visited the park, the Allison's house was near the Georgia Street entrance. They passed by there, and a lady had her skirt sort of swiped at by this bear cub. So it, suddenly this bear becomes a public hazard and needs to be put in a cage. And that seems to have been the start of the zoo. It's a informal process at the beginning where people offer the Allisons various animals that they have come across. And then as time goes on, the Parks Board starts to self-consciously see this as a zoo and to build it as a zoo. And they start accepting donations from other cities and also from ship's captains who are passing through Vancouver and are bringing exotic creatures from around the world. It becomes it's quite a big part of Stanley Park, certainly by the 1910s.
So at the same time that you've got crow shoots happening and
oh, yes.
A cougar was shot, I believe, in the park at one point, then you also have animals from other places on exhibit. A very strange kind of situation.
We were very excited in the museum's collection. I'm afraid the museum, being an old institution, was complicit back then in all this rearranging of nature. We became the recipient of the emu eggs and of the stuffed peacock and the stuffed polar bear from Stanley Park, so we were able to have those as part of the exhibit.
Now, I know you're not a scientist, you're an art curator, but I'm wondering, as a part of the process of doing all this exhibit, how you think, what your thoughts are on how the park should be managed in the coming century?
Well, I think it's impossible to have an urban park so close to a big downtown area. Fundamentally, the issue is fire suppression. If you're going to suppress fire in Stanley Park, then you're going to mess with the forest and the animals in some fundamental way. So I think if you start with the idea that we can't let a forest fire blaze through Stanley Park, then we know we have to be self-conscious then about, okay, this isn't natural. In what ways are we going to be manipulating nature? What are we prepared to do? And what are we prepared to call it? I was really just asking people to open their eyes and for all of us, because we know it's not natural. We just like to talk about it like it is. So let's just be honest with ourselves and with one another.
Well, it's a great show, and I really encourage people to go. And thanks very much for talking to me this morning about it.
Oh, you're welcome. You were you're the sort of attentive visitor that I dream about. So it's wonderful to answer your questions.
Okay, bye-bye, Joan.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Joan Seidel. She's curator of the Unnatural History of Stanley Park, and you can see the show at the Vancouver Museum at 1100 Chestnut Street. It's on until the middle of February.